This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Welcome to this episode of Tea with Twiggy. It's great to have you here. This is a podcast where I catch up with friends and people that I find fascinating. I check that they're doing okay and ask for tips to help us stay at home more comfortable. My guest this week is undeniably the First Lady of British Musical Theatre. She has starred in some of the West End's best-known shows, including Evita and Chess, not to mention originating the role of Grisabella in Cats. She has won numerous awards for her theatre roles and has the most beautiful voice and the best giggle. I'm delighted to be having a cup of tea with the lovely Elaine Page. Elaine, hello. Thank you for having tea with me.
Tea with Twigs. What could be better?
What tea are you drinking?
I'm drinking my favourite tea. It's PG Tips.
Oh, Builder's tea.
That's it. The Builder's, yes. The Builder's favourite. Yep.
Are you a tea drinker or are you kind of tend to go for coffee?
No, I never drink coffee. I am very much a tea drinker. I love the smell of coffee, but unfortunately, if I drink it, which I do on occasion, rarely, because it makes me nauseous for some reason. But I love the smell of it.
I get heartburn, which is interesting. I can't drink coffee.
No, I don't either, really. I'm a tea girl.
Me too. It's funny because, I mean, we've known each other for quite a long time. We've had this discussion that we actually should have known each other as kids because our backgrounds are pretty similar, aren't they?
They are, because we're both, North London, aren't we? We're Londoners. You're a little further east, I think, than me. I was born and brought up in Barnet in Hertfordshire.
Okay. No, I was North West London. I was in Easton, near the football ground.
All right, you're west of me then, yes.
Yeah.
But that's not so far, is it, between us, really?
No. But we didn't know each other because we are roughly the same age, I think. And I didn't go to drama school, which you did. You went to a theatrical school, didn't you?
No, I went to a state school originally. I went to an all-girls secondary modern school in Whetstone. And my whole schooling, my entire life, was at state school. And then when I was 16, I left that school and went to Ada Foster, which was a drama school in Temple Fortune near Golders Green. And I went there at the age of 16 and I did a three-year students course there of dance and drama. So I'd already completed my so-called education.
Were you thinking you wanted to go into musical theatre at that point?
I knew that I wanted, yes. I think by the time I was 16, having had a most marvellous music teacher at my Southall Secondary Modern Girls' School, her name was Anne Hill, and she was, you know, quite wonderful in the fact that she taught us musical appreciation and taught us to read music and turned us on really to the classics, the classical writers like Handel and Mozart and so on. And she would put on rather ambitious productions at the end of school term, like Handel's Messiah and things like that. Mm. And I remember we did a production of The Boy Mozart and I played Susanna. And it was sort of a compilation of Mozart's hits, I suppose you'd say. It was like Mamma Mia, is today. We would have called it Mama Mozart, because it was a compilation of his hits. And I played Susanna, and I had a wonderful aria, a solo to sing. And that was really the beginnings for me. I think that's when I really knew that this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to be able to sing in musical theatre. And then, of course, on top of that, the girls that were older than me, they were the year above me, the sixth form, they had an album of West Side Story. And so they said to me, did I want to go to their dorm? You know, they had like a prefix room. Did I want to go to their dorm and listen to this album? And it was having done that, plus this wonderful teacher, Anne Hill, and learning, you know, Mozart and the Handel Sound, things like this, that sort of turned me on to the whole idea.
When did you realise you had that voice, that famous, famous voice? Did you know from a very young age you could sing?
I knew I liked to sing. I didn't know I had anything particular kind of voice in any way, but I knew I enjoyed singing. I loved assembly every morning at school. You know, we used to, I don't know if they still do it today, but we would every morning stand and sing hymns, and then be a dissertation, and the headmistress would read something from the Bible. And I always enjoyed those gatherings first thing in the morning. And I was teased very much as a young student at school. All my contemporaries would say, yeah, go on, sing out Bix, you know, sing out Titch. They would mock me because I did used to sing out with gusto because I loved it. I loved singing. But it was Anne Hill, really, and through her teaching and these ambitious productions at the end of term, that's what consolidated the knowledge in me that I knew I loved to sing, and that wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to be able to do that for a living, you know?
It's interesting because I ask everyone that I've been talking to if there was a special person in their life that changed their life or inspired them, and actually you've answered that.
Well, she was definitely one. There have been several in my life, but she was the first, I would say, that really, I suppose it was through her and her, she inspired me really and gave me the confidence. And I think I knew from the way she would give me the odd solo here and there that she obviously felt that I had something, had a voice of some sort. And she was definitely the first.
Yeah, I actually think that you actually hit the nail on the head when you said she inspired you, but she gave you the confidence, because my special person was Ken Russell, the film director, who sadly is not with us anymore. And when he cast me in The Boyfriend, because, you know, I was happily modelling. I was doing very well.
Yeah, you were indeed.
I didn't really think of not doing that. And then I met Ken, and he inspired me, and because he gave me the confidence, because I was really nervous. You know, I'd never acted, I'd never sung or danced apart from at school. And it's interesting that if you have somebody that you look up to and that you admire, if they are saying to you, you can do it, it really makes all the difference, I think.
Absolutely correct. And in this, The Boy Mozart, the aria I had to sing was something called De Vieni Non Tada. And that is the famous aria that Susanna sings in The Marriage of Figaro. And who would have thought that I could, singing in a foreign language as well. Once so young, I was probably only about 15 years old, and I've got a recording of this particular performance that she obviously recorded the whole thing, and in latter years, because I'm still in touch with her. Yeah, she's well into her 80s now, but on an odd occasion we go out for lunch together and reminisce about those days, and she presented me with a copy of a cassette of me singing this aria.
She must be so proud of you, my goodness.
Well, it's, you know, everybody's got to start somewhere, I suppose. And as you said, we all need that one person just to give you the nudge and give you the confidence and tell you that, yes, you can.
So you're, am I right in saying your first time in the West End was in Hair? Is that right?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I had worked in other theatres, you know, but not actually in the West End until Hair. And it was the end of the year, 1967. Oh, my goodness me, all those years ago. At the Shaftesbury Theatre. Yep. I was very much in the chorus, but so happy to be part of that particular show because it was innovative, you know.
I say it was groundbreaking.
It was groundbreaking, absolutely. And it encompassed everything that I think of now as a part of the 60s, of that era of we thought we were going to change the world, didn't we?
I know, we did. We did for a little bit.
We did. For a while we did.
Some of it went a bit wrong, but some of it didn't.
Well, maybe some of it now is coming back. You know, I was only thinking recently, you know, where is that ideal gone? Where is the love for one another and the kindness and where's all that gone? And in fact, a concert tour that I'm doing at the moment, or have been doing for the last couple of years, is all about that, really, saying about, you know, it's all to do with those songs from that period, because it was all very much about, you know, allowing one to be oneself and not hurting anybody, and the I Ching and all the wonderful philosophy that we used to hang on to in those days was all about allowing each other the freedoms and to express oneself as long as you didn't hurt anyone. That was the idea. Be free to do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt anybody. And these concerts that I've been giving of late, it sort of saddened me to have to say, where has that ideal gone? And of course now I think that is very much coming back to the fore, that idea of people sort of checking each other out and saying, are you all right? And can I get you shopping? And can I help in any way?
But what's interesting is I think when we do come out of this, inevitably we will. I don't know how long it's going to take. But I think people will have a different attitude to each other because of what's happened. And that's what I hope.
I think you're right. I mean, that's what I was trying to say, I think, really, in the fact that this COVID-19 thing, it's impacted us, hasn't it? It's impacted the whole world, actually, in such an unprecedented kind of way. And each of us are having to face up, really, to our own individual challenges. And and I think really what I'm trying to say is that we're all trying to adapt, aren't we? To our own, well, loss of freedoms for a start, and you know, loss of contact with friends, and to a very much slower pace of life.
Yeah, I think our lives were getting so fast. There was never time to do anything. There was never time to see everybody. Oh, because everyone's so busy, and we've got to do this, and we've got to do that. We've been forced now to stop.
Yes,
we can't go out, and
that's right.
You know, a bit of exercise, and actually. You were saying, and I was talking to Chris Biggins earlier, and he was saying he's actually quite enjoying that because you start to relook at things that you never had time for before.
Absolutely right. I agree with him. Right from the off, really. I'm really rather enjoying the slower pace of life, the idea that we've now got time to kind of stop and smell the roses, as it were. and on the positive side, I think it's allowing us you know, to be more creative if you feel in the mood, and to learn new skills and things, which I've been doing with a computer. I mean, like this, for example. Yes. And I've learned how to download and get on Zoom. I mean, these are things I would never have dreamt I could do before. You know, self-taping. I've done a bit of that for fun to try and cheer everybody up. You know, video communication like this and with friends. It's been a bit of an eye-opener, really. And instilled in me the idea again that, you know, if you try hard enough, you can achieve these things that prior I might have thought, oh, I can't do that. But now there's no choice in a way. It's pushed you, forced one into having to try and give everything a go.
Yeah, well, I actually downloaded an app the other day of Teach Yourself Piano, because I took some piano lessons about 20 years ago for about 2 months, because there was a guy in our building who was a piano teacher, and we've got a nice piano. I thought, I can read music, and I love songs, but I could never play the piano. So I started to take them, and then we went to America for like 4 months, so it all fell apart. But I thought, now's the perfect time, because they've got these apps you can go on.
I didn't know that.
Simple Piano or something, I think it's called.
And how are you getting on with it? Is it easy or not?
I've downloaded the app.
Well done. She's downloaded the app. Well, I tell you what, you talking about piano, it's really interesting, because I've got a beautiful grand piano here. And so I got out all my early, early learning books, school books, of teaching yourself to play the piano.
Well, there you go.
And so I didn't know about the app. I didn't think of that, you see. I never think first about finding it out on the computer. But now you've said that, I'm definitely going to give it a go.
There's a few. If you go into your app store, there's a few. But I think I'd been told that one of the best ones is this Simple Piano.
Oh, I'm going to write it down.
I think it's called
Simple Piano.
We can get together for a duet.
Oh, darling. There'll be no holding us. We'll be in a band soon. But it is interesting how, you know, hobbies and things like that, and things that you think you've never got time for, that's the thing, isn't it?
I know.
Reading. I mean, I've got lots and lots of wonderful books here. I'm a bit of one of those that I read in the Times or the Telegraph, books that are coming out, and I love to read the reviews, and often would read reviews of whatever book it was or whatever, and think, oh, I'll get that, I'd like to read that, and go and buy the thing, and then of course it's on the bookshelf here. It's probably never been opened. So that is a wonderful thing, and I've got 3 books on the go at the moment. One I was halfway through already, which I love, because it's a little paperback that I've got, and when I travel, I take it with me. But I'm one of those kind of people, I can't read more than a chapter at a time. I seem to fall asleep. I don't know what it is, whether it's the actual action of my eyes moving back and forth across the page. I don't know, but it sends me to sleep. But so I'm taking rather a long time to finish Barry Humphrey's biography. And it's a good book, though, because it's quite funny, because it's called My Life as Me. And I can hear his voice as I read it. And some of the anecdotal, you know, stories are very funny indeed. And so I'm reading that. I'm also reading Hugh Vickers. A friend of mine gave it to me for my birthday. It's a book called The Sphinx, and it's all about the Duchess of Marlborough. I've only just begun that, but I think it's going to be quite interesting. And then a friend of mine brought me this. It's rather apt right now, because as I go for a walk in the park, it's by this chap called Jonathan Drury, and it's called Around the World in 80 Trees. And so now we've got the time to, well, not only look out of the window at them, but I can walk around the beautiful park and try and identify the trees, because, again, something I might have learned in the brownies years ago, but certainly can't remember now. I was in the brownies, but I never flew up to be a girl guide, I'm afraid. No, you had to fly up, and I never made it.
Brilliant. Oh, how did you meet Andrew Lloyd Webber? Was it when you... did you have to audition for?
Well, I think the first time I ever encountered Andrew Lloyd Webber was for an audition for Jesus Christ Superstar in the 70s, early 70s. And they asked me if I would understudy Mary Magdalene. And having understudied in Hair prior, a couple of years before, it was so traumatic and so frightening to be thrown on without rehearsal. And indeed, I was thrown on to understudy for a role that I wasn't an understudy for. So I didn't know the role at all. I just had miraculously learned it by osmosis, by hearing it night after night. But it was so terrifying to me, this understudy behaviour. I just thought, this is not for me. I can't, this is never going to work for me. I can't do it. So when they asked me if I would understudy for Mary, I said, oh, no, I don't think so. And the other thing was, I thought if you become an understudy, then you never ever get to actually play the role. They always pass over you for somebody else. So I wouldn't do that. But so I was in the chorus of Jesus Christ Superstar. But that's where I first auditioned for Andrew and Tim Rice. And but then, of course, many years later, or at least 8 or 9 years later, when I auditioned again for Evita, and then, of course, I got to meet them up close and personal, as it were, because I must have done, 8 or 9 auditions for back and back and back. Every time I had to go back, and every time I went back wearing the same dress, the same pair of shoes, that pulled my hair up, you know, in the hope that they would remember me from last time. If I wore the same thing, I thought they might, you know, they might remember me. Which they did.
They obviously did.
They did. They did, luckily, yes. And many years later, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this on a podcast, but many years later, you can always edit it out if you think it's too rude. But Hal Prince said to me, he said, I always remembered you from those auditions for Evita. And I said, did you? I was rather amazed to hear this. Did you? Why is that? He said, because I always remember you always wore the same dress and your hair the same. He said, but the thing I remember most was that those fuck me shoes. And I said, I beg your pardon. And I wore these shoes. They were great big sort of platform heels at the time. And because it was in the 70s. And they, you know, you had the thing, the ankle strap. He said, those, I remember those shoes, he said. So
have you still got?
I probably have somewhere in storage. Oh. They were bottle green and they were metallic. Metallic leather, bottle green shoes.
Well, and I obviously like
and
them.
I had a bottle green leather, three-quarter length collarless leather jacket. Again, you know, it was the, you had to be a mod or a rocker, didn't you?
Yeah, I
wanted
a mod.
To be a mod.
I was a mod.
See, another thing connects us.
I know. I remember talking about that. I used to make, because you had to wear, it was like a uniform.
Yes, it
you
was
had to
a uniform,
wear
you're
right.
Thing,
yep. Didn't you? You didn't want to be individual, you know.
No, you wanted to be part of the gang.
I mean, I must have looked like olive oil because I can remember. No, because I was so skinny. Yes. And I can remember there was one summer where everyone was in grey pleated skirts below the knee.
That's right.
Hush puppy shoes. Yeah. Can you imagine my legs in hush puppy?
Hilarious.
Oh, my goodness. But we did have fun.
Yeah, it was a great... I mean, weren't we lucky, really, to live through that era, I think?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, there was everything going on then. We had wonderful music coming out of everywhere, Liverpool particularly. Then there was the Beach Boys and that wonderful... Yep. You know what I mean? All those different...
It was kind of surf music.
Surfing music, exactly.
Went on to people like the Eagles. Yeah. I mean, the music.
And then we had you and the modelling era and Bieber.
Oh, Barbara Hulanicki.
Barbara,
one of my
yes.
oldest friends.
And Bieber.
Oh, she
changed the fashion world. You changed the modelling world and the fashion world. We had the hairdressers, didn't we? Lulu married. Yeah, absolutely, and it was all dark, wasn't it? And the stands with the hats on and the clothes all hanging off stands. It was so individual and fresh and new and innovative that we'd never seen anything like it. It was like a mini department store of modern clothes that you thought, "Wow, this is for us, for our age group." It was.
I know.
Just
well, it was
fantastic.
Before I was discovered, and I used to. I had a Saturday job. I was a schoolgirl, but I had a Saturday job at the hairdressers where my sister.
Oh,
worked.
So did I. I had a Saturday job. I used to wash people's hair and pick up the pins.
Me too. That's hysterical. So I used to save up my tips, you know, because they'd give you sixpence or a shilling if you wash the hair, and I'd save it up for about a month, and then in a lunch hour, me and the other junior girl would get on the tube in Queensway and go two stops to High Street Ken and run down the road because we only had an hour, and go into Bieber and buy a dress, because you could get a dress for £2.50, yeah, couldn't you? And I always remember, because they had feather boas,
that's
everywhere,
right,
and beautiful lamps and playing music. I mean, shops didn't play music in those days.
No, you're right.
And all the sales girls were gorgeous, weren't they?
And all beautifully made up.
And the floppy hats, they are. The
huge brimmed floppy hats. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was such a creative, artistic time to be young and to be free. Well, we were the first teenagers, really, weren't we, when you think of it? We really were. I mean, there wasn't such a thing until then. And we were the first. You know, and the scooter, the guys on the scooters and the mods, you know, you had to have a Lambretta, didn't you?
Yeah, well, my mum and dad wouldn't let me go on the back of one, but we all used to watch the boys go by. There was one lead guy in the place where we used to go as on a Saturday night. It was like a club above a Burton's Tailoring thing. We saw people like Eric Clapton and Eric Burdon and the Animals.
Yes.
I mean,
amazing
people.
There
was this mod guy, I can't remember his name now, but all the girls loved him, and he would sit outside the club on his scooter, kind of
revving it up.
like a peacock. But he wore great, you know, those high-necked pink gingham shirts. And
the flowery shirts the boys used to have, didn't they? Those lots of flowers. I think Andrew Lloyd Webber still got some in his wardrobe. it was a wonderful, wonderful era to be young and free.
Yeah, we were very, very, very lucky. Now, I've always wanted to ask you that you have recorded some of the most famous, wonderful songs ever written. Songs from Evita, Memory, Don't Cry For Me, Argentine. Have you got a favourite?
It's always difficult, really, to answer that. I mean, when I was in Evita, I mean, it was one of those things, whatever show I was in at the time, they were my favourite songs to be singing at the time. But I think probably the ones that still stand out to me and that I never, ever tire of singing amazingly, and I must have sung some of these songs thousands and thousands of times now since the beginning, you know, since those early musicals that I was in all those years ago. Obviously, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, is one that I never tire of singing it. And every time I sing it, I remember the rehearsals that I had with the great late Hal Prince, who was directed. And I remember every time I sing it, he comes into my mind, and those early bars of music before I begin to sing, he said, he's one of his directions to me was, make sure at this point that you look down on the audience, even though you won't be able to see them individually, they think you're looking at them, he said individually, look down at them and pick people out and stare them out. And he tried to remind me that even though it's a beautiful melody, he said, forget about the beauty of the melody of the song. He said, really, it's in essence a political speech, and I want you to think of it in those terms, and I want you to connect with individuals in the audience and try and hammer home your point of view as if you were a great politician and you're giving a political speech of your life. And I must say that as I've grown into the song, all these songs, the longer you live with them, you know, they become like a old pair of slippers or something. You get to know them so well, excuse the pun. But, you know, one is always learning a new take on how to deliver the lyric. And so that's one that will always stand out to me and remain to the forefront of my the ones that I love to.
And I hope everyone caught your little Twitter version of it. That is
don't
truly
cry for me,
brilliant.
I'm the cleaner, which of course I have truly become.
Well, me too. I'm really good at ironing.
Oh
now.
No, I haven't gone there. I can't go there. Oh no, I'm washing and I'm cleaning. I love cleaning. I am, and I do sing. Don't cry for me, I'm the cleaner, as I'm dusting and things. But I,
if people haven't seen it, go onto Twitter, onto Elaine's page. It's truly brilliant.
Right, it's just a silly piece of nonsense. But that one stands out to me. But the other one, of course, is memory and. That will always be something special to me because, luckily for me, I was the first to ever sing it at all.
It's your song, Elaine.
I am quite protective of it. I feel like it's my signature song, if one should be lucky enough to have one. I think that is mine. And I never tire of singing that either. And again, the older I get, the more it makes sense, if you know what I mean.
And it is your song because, as you say, lots of people have recorded it. But they ain't got it on you, honey.
Yeah, the other one, of course, is I Know Him So Well because...
That's one of my favourite songs.
That, you know, that was a number one hit for me and Barbara Dixon. And so the only one I've ever had, but it was special because of that. And
wasn't memory a number one?
No. I think it got to about number five or three or something.
Wow. I'm absolutely amazed. But I Know Him So Well. It's one of the great songs ever.
Well, it's one of those songs from a musical that, I mean, extraordinary, really, when you think about it. A musical theatre song getting to number one is pretty outrageous. I don't know that it's been done since either. Come to that.
I don't think it has.
But it is something rather special and clearly something that, because of its subject matter, something that connected with people out there, which made them go and buy it, I guess. Yeah.
Exactly. And you were in Chess, weren't you?
Yeah.
How long did you do it for?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I was, you know, around at its inception. Tim wrote it for me, really, because I was hoping to go to Broadway with Evita and then hoping to go with Cats, and I didn't go with either show for reasons they say was to do with equity reasons. Which of course today have all changed completely. But so he said to me, well, I'm going to get you to Broadway, I'm going to write a musical for you. Well, that in itself is unheard of. Then and today even more so. Nobody writes musicals for people anymore, as in the old days they did for Ethel Merman and so on. It just doesn't happen today. And so Chess is something that's very special to me because it was written with me in mind. And and again, though, I didn't get to Broadway with it, the irony of it is, though that's what Tim's aim was.
They were all so strict in those days, weren't they?
Well, they were, and but actually, in that case, I was lucky really not to go with it because it was a disaster and didn't run for more than a matter of a few performances. So, every cloud has a silver lining.
What when it opened in New York, you mean? Oh, that's interesting.
They changed it. Trevor Nunn altered the text and the storyline quite considerably and changed the set design, everything about it. It lost a great deal, I think, in its presentation, in its production values. And,
so I was lucky, really, then, because I didn't come to London with my one and only, but we originated the musical I did in the 80s on Broadway. So I was very lucky that I was allowed to do it, actually.
You were? Were you living over there at the time?
Yeah, I was.
Well, maybe that had something to do with it,
maybe.
I think.
Yeah.
You know, you were already over there and possibly, and you were working with Tommy.
With Tommy, and Tommy was like the king of Broadway at
that's
the time.
Right. So that you had a lot of help in that respect.
I had a lot of help, honey.
You know, well, no, you were working with, you know, the best of the best. Yeah.
Well, and same as you.
And living there, that must have helped.
Yeah.
But I got there eventually with Sunset Boulevard. That's some right. 18 years later it took me to get there, but I got there in the end. So
there is something magical about appearing on
magic, Broadway. Absolutely.
It is.
And there's something about performing for an audience that is not of your own country. Mm-hmm. I don't know, they seem to appreciate me quite a lot when I was there, and I think probably because they'd heard about me for so many years, well, for 18 years, with Evita and Cats and Chess, and that I'd never performed on Broadway. So by the time I got there, luckily for me, they kind of already knew who I was through the recordings, through the albums. So to actually kind of see me in the flesh, I suppose, for them was, it was, anyway, all I know it was worth the wait for me, because as you say, there is something very special about those audiences. They're very vociferous, aren't they?
If they love you on Broadway, they really love you. But on the opposite side, if they don't like you, we had a friend who opened in a straight play, quite a well-known actor, I won't say his name, but he'd gone out, this is about 20 years ago, and he opened in a play, and they did the opening night. They went to Sardi's, which is the restaurant you go to on opening night, and they were all drinking champagne and whatever, and, you know, very up and high. And the reviews came out about midnight, and the producers were over in the corner, and suddenly they shut the bar. They were taking their champagne glasses away because they got slaughtered in the reviews, and they all had a plane ticket at their hotel to go home the next day.
That's
a true story. Isn't that awful?
Oh, that is terrible. Well, I've known a couple in my life that have not been successful, but it was early on in my career. But I've never known anything quite that extreme.
That was pretty cruel. Pretty cruel. So we're both associates of the Mount View Drama Academy Theatre School. And I just wondered how you got involved. It's a wonderful, wonderful drama school, isn't it? And now they've got this new building in Peckham. And I know you've been very supportive of them. And, you know, we try and help as much as we can. Because it does provide the West End with a lot of musical performers. I think most shows in the West End that are musical, the kids come from Mount View, a lot of them.
They do. Mount View does seem to be able to, they bring in young students that they seem to tap into a certain talent, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And are able over the 3-year course that these young students take in musical theatre or drama or whatever it is they're taking. They really do manage to spot talent in these young people right off the bat, and are able to nurture this talent over this period of time. Yes, I can't quite remember how I became involved with them. I think possibly it was some years ago. I think I went and gave a sort of a masterclass there, and talked about singing and stagecraft and so on and so
forth. Well, you are the first lady of British musical theatre, darling. So they were very lucky to get you. My God, they must have been so excited.
Well, it was fun, and it was something that I never really thought I'd ever have the confidence to do myself, you know, to be able to express or tell anybody anything of any use. I've just sort of muddled through in my own career, so I never actually believed I could do it. But I thought, well, I'll give it a go. And I went along and actually found out something about myself that I actually really rather enjoyed being able to, and had a lot of tips and things that I could pass on to them, which was just wonderful to be able to unburden myself, if you like, of all these various things I'd learned along the way in my long career that were apparently useful to them. And indeed, latterly, some time ago, a few years ago, they gave me a doctorate, which was jolly nice of them. And so I went along and accepted that. Of course, it was with great honour to be given such a thing. And then just quite recently, I've they've created a bursary for a student there. I'm going to be able to support a young student that possibly couldn't afford to go there under their own means. They've created a bursary in my name, so I'm really pleased about that as well.
That's the wonderful thing about Mount View. They do, if they think somebody's got the talent, they'll find the money somehow. They will not let that person go, which is
I've said that I'll you know, I will do that. I will, I don't know what you call it.
Fund it.
Fund it, yes, I suppose. I'm going to fund that bursary for musical theatre, excellence in musical theatre. So it'll be interesting and it'll be wonderful for me as well, because I'll be able to see and watch this person, this particular person, grow from their early beginnings of the course through to the end of the course. Excellent. So it's gonna be beneficial on both sides, I think, both for the student and for me personally. Yeah.
Oh, it'd be amazing for them. Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, you gave my husband Lee one of the most magical times of his life. Do you remember on his 70th birthday?
And
you sang happy birthday to him in the restaurant.
I do.
He tells everybody. Elaine Page sang happy birthday to him. It was amazing.
I do remember doing that. I'm quite partial to singing happy birthday to people, because at least I remember the words to that.
So are you out clapping every Thursday night?
I am out clapping every Thursday night, sadly alone, because I'm in a building where I don't think there seems to be anybody else. I stand out on this balcony terrace here behind me and clap away. I can see people coming and going in the park who aren't clapping, and last Thursday I got a bit cross with them and said, come on. Clap, put your hands together, clap for these wonderful NHS staff who are saving all our lives. Why aren't you clapping? And people look up at me and, you know, mope off. And I got a bit cross and called out at them and said, you should be ashamed of yourselves. You should be clapping to be glad to be alive. Anyway, there I was completely ignored. But I stood there clapping heartily myself, indeed. I mean, the work they are doing is just, well... Words fail, don't they, really?
They do.
For their courage, their bravery and their courage and commitment and 12-hour shifts. And it really is. They really are on the front line with, worryingly, this PPE thing going on and on and on. Where are our people in our factories now that
I know.
Could be, instead of making whatever they're doing, why can't they be making PPE for these people?
I think some of the fashion house I read yesterday, some of the fashion houses are switching to that, and that's
they
what they
really should be doing. It if only we could it, yeah. you know, get everybody to be doing that in our own country and not relying on buying it in from outside, you know, a bit like the women in the war went on the land, didn't they? The ladies of the land went and organized the food while the men went off and fought, and the women went to the factories and made bullets and casings and all kinds of things. Well, that's the kind of thing we need now.
I think there is the will out there,
but it doesn't seem to be. There's some missing link in the chain, isn't there, from the willingness of the people, which indeed, as you say, is there. But there's a link missing in the fruition and it getting to the people that need it. But wow, I mean, my heart goes out to them. They are angels, all of them angels.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, I think I'd like to say thank you for joining me for tea. Ooh. And when this is all over and we can get together, we will have proper tea.
We'll have proper tea and a big hug. I'm desperate for a hug.
A big hug. I know, me too.
Oh, at least you've got Lee.
I've got a huggy Lee. But, I'm missing my kids and my grandkids.
And what about the new baby?
He's gorgeous.
Oh, what's his name again?
Theo.
And did Theo get the thing, the little present, the gift?
Did you post it?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I'll have to check.
Oh, okay. It was a little...
The post has gone a bit mad.
Yeah. Well, it was just before all this happened. So I think they would have got it.
Probably.
But it's a little muffler thing, you know, like a little a comfort blanket.
Oh, you are sweet.
Well, I wanted it because I thought you were coming over. You said I was going to give it to you to give to them. And it all went.
Well, I only ever held him twice.
Oh.
The day he was born and then a week later. And I can't see them.
But you see him on video, don't you?
Oh, yeah. We Skype most days.
Oh, beautiful. Lovely. It's lovely to see you, darling.
We'll keep in touch. I'll talk to you soon.
Yes.
Lots of love.
Love you lots. Au revoir.
I loved catching up with Elaine and hearing her stories of the numerous shows she starred in. And don't forget to listen to her fabulous Radio 2 show on musical theatre every Sunday afternoon. If you've enjoyed listening to Tea with Twiggy, please take a moment to give us a lovely 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people to find the show. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to this podcast so you automagically get the next episodes for free. And do tell all your friends and family about it too. If you want to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Twiggy, or you can find me on Instagram at Twiggy Lawson. My thanks go to all the people that have helped this podcast happen. Many thanks to James Carroll and all the team at North Bank Talent Management. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits the show, my producer Kobe Omanaka, and executive producers Tom Wally and Dave Corkery. The music you can hear now is my version of Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. If you'd like to hear the whole song, you can find it and all the other songs I've recorded on iTunes and Spotify. So check it out. I look forward to you joining me for my next episode. So see you then. Bye.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel-Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.